The following program was produced by the Theosophical Society in America.
There seems to be no better way of honoring the founders, both of whom took the Buddhist vows, the Panchashila, and openly declared themselves to be Buddhists. Not Buddhists in the conventional sense of the term, but according to the use that Sinnett made of that word, spelt with a single D, and Buddhism, Buddhi signifying higher intelligence. And they were Buddhists in that sense. And as you know, the term the middle way is very much associated with Buddhism and the Buddhist teachings. It was a term which came into currency with the great holy teacher and philosopher Nagarjuna, who lived in the 2nd century and who expounded this concept of the middle way. But the concept itself, not the term, existed much earlier. For example, in the Upanishads, there is mention of the razor-edged path. That means a path on which you had to go straight ahead carefully and not stray here and there. Perhaps a similar idea exists also when the sentence was used, straight is the gate and narrow the way. And there is a possibility of finding similar ideas in the different religions of the world. The razor-edged path suggests that there are dangers, the danger of falling off or falling down on one side or another. It is like what the circus people do, walking on a wire. One has to remain in perfect balance to go along that path. It may be the same idea which was presented by Thomas A. Kempis, who said that it is necessary to let go of all aims except the one aim of journeying towards the light, wisdom, eternal, and so on. And in Indian tradition, all of us who know at the feet of the master know that the chapter entitled Love had its origin in a teaching we spoke about the earnest aspiration to liberation. But the Sanskrit term, which was translated as the desire for liberation, speaks about it as a kind of single-mindedness, letting go of all aims, but the one aim of finding the true, the eternal. And only on that middle path, actually, one is completely safe. If you use the term the razor edge path, it seems as if it's a dangerous path. But it is the safest of all paths, because it is the path where a complete equilibrium is preserved. And therefore, there is complete security. You are not pushed off. It is a path where there is profound peace, a path which is absolute harmony. If you stray from that path and get lost in the surroundings, finding other paths and so on, there may be conflict, there may be hesitation. But when you tread the middle path, it is secure because it is one pointed. And in it can be found harmony from beginning to end. As you know, in the Mahatma letters, they wrote, we recognize but one law in the universe, the law of harmony, of perfect equilibrium. There are several definitions given in the Bhagavad Gita of what is yoga. And one of the very well-known definitions is yoga is equilibrium. Yoga is the unbreakable peace which human beings can come to if they tread the right path. Yoga is a sublime sense of harmony. In fact, the universe itself is in that state of harmony. In the dialogues that J. Krishnamurti had with David Bohm, he makes the rather startling statement, the universe itself is in a state of meditation. That means a state in which there is total harmony, peace, bliss. Otherwise, meditation is not possible. There is balance all over the universe. Sir Martin Rees, the eminent scientist who is the British Astronomer Royal, in his book on six numbers, states that there is that kind of equilibrium or balance in the cosmos itself. According to him, these six numbers are either very, very small or very large, representing various forces in the universe. But all those forces exist in a state of equilibrium. It is very similar to the Eastern idea that there are three gunas or three kinds of forces working throughout manifestation. And when they are in a state of equilibrium, it is called spiritual, sattva, true, and so on. Martin Rees mentions that the force of gravity is in a state of fine balance through the ages with the force of expansion. If the force of gravity were too great, the universe will collapse into nothing. If the force of expansion is too great, the universe will expand away into nothingness. But all this doesn't happen. For ages, the universe remains preserved in that state of very fine equilibrium. In Indian tradition, they said that the second aspect of the Logos, called Vishnu, he is the preserver. That is the principle which maintains balance in the universe. And when there is that kind of balance, there is a unity of all opposites. If there were not such a unity, there could not be that equilibrium either. So, when that balance is disturbed a little, duality arises and then continues on the path of diversity. In this diverse world, it is difficult for us to be aware of that kind of balance and of the existence of an unbreakable unity. But only when we come to realize that diversity is not different from unity, we can really experience something of the immanence of God, the presence of the one reality everywhere. And I believe that we should stop thinking of unity in diversity and begin to think of unity as diversity and diversity as unity. They are the same, as many examples will show. The flower, any flower, is made up of different things, but it is a unity. They speak about the thousand-petaled lotus as a symbol of the fact that there can be any number of different things, but from the point of view of reality, they all form part of one, that one blossom. In Buddhist tradition, they also speak about the universe itself appearing like a vast lotus flower. The word thousand does not literally mean thousand, it only means innumerable, uncountable. And they say at the tip of every petal of that lotus, a Buddha is seated, which means that from all those different areas, a person can come to a state of enlightenment and perfection. In nature, we find it almost everywhere that there is a growth which is balanced. It's not only that the forces of the universe are balanced, but everything grows in a balanced way. H.P.B. mentions this in one of her writings, that a baby which begins as a tiny little embryo doesn't put out one leg first and then the nose and things like that. The baby grows in an all-round way and takes perfect shape. So do all things. And they also know where growth should end. That is a very extraordinary thing that in nature. A coconut tree is a beautiful example of a tree which goes on up into the air, perhaps 70 or 80 feet, and yet it retains its balance. It knows when it should stop growing in order to not to topple down. So, in many of the phenomena of nature, there is this wholeness, the harmonious blending of all parts, but we are unable to see the significance of it because our minds are in a state of duality. Our minds are divided into different divisions. And the Gita speaks about a consciousness which rises entirely above all duality and diversity. And that is really the middle way. You know, we cannot think of light without darkness or darkness without light. When we use the word pleasure, implicit in it is the absence of pain and vice versa. Everything seems either good or bad to a more or less extent. But all of that is part of the world of unreality or Maya, the worlds of illusion. Things are not good or bad. All things are what they are. They are not pleasurable or painful. They are what they are. But our mind interprets what we experience as either pleasure or as pain, as likable or unlikable, as attractive or not attractive. So it is within our being at present, our mental being really, that we have created duality, division, and therefore we bring about imbalance in ourselves and in all our surroundings. And since the universe itself is in a state of meditation, that is of profound harmony, and the law of harmony is the most important of all the laws and includes all the laws, the universe brings about a restoration of the harmony wherever it is broken to a larger or a smaller extent. And that is the law of karma. This again is explained by H.P.B. that the law of karma is not a punishment. The law of karma is a beneficent power which brings, restores harmony all the time whenever human beings create problems because they see everything in terms of duality and division. Therefore, a pathway which restores harmony, which maintains harmony from beginning to end, is the best pathway, and that is the middle way. Long before Nagarjuna spoke or wrote, yes, Nagarjuna wrote a number of works, the Buddha gave his first sermon near the city of Varanasi. And he said in that first sermon that all excess should be avoided by a person who wishes to tread the spiritual path. In his day and even today, there are people who practice extreme austerity, standing for years with one arm lifted till it withers away, or lying on a bed of needles. There are people who practice such things even now. And he said that kind of extreme austerity serves no purpose. He himself tried it according to tradition. On the other hand, there is indulgence, not just taking simple pleasure in things, but indulging in pleasure. Becoming addicted to pleasure. Pleasure orientation, if we may put it that way, that is also to be avoided. There must be no attachment to pleasure, nor a repulsion of what appears as pain. And if karma brings about what is painful to us, perhaps it's more important to think about how imbalance has been created rather than resist the karma. In the voice of the silence, there is the statement, chafe not at karma. Can we accept karma with a calm, observant mind and look intelligently into what underlies that karma? Anyhow, the Lord Buddha in his first sermon, he spoke about non-indulgence and also of avoiding austerity. The body has to be preserved and looked after. But if we give too much attention to the body, it becomes a kind of self-preoccupation. If we give too much attention to all the things around us, it becomes materialism. And so, although the body has to be looked after, we must not overdo it, because there is that which is dwelling inside the body, which unfolds its powers through the body. So he spoke about this. And also, many a time, if tradition is to be believed, he spoke about an inner balance of our psychological being. I don't like to use the word mind, which seems to separate desire from thought. The Sanskrit word manas, on the other hand, indicates that complex of desire and thinking, which is what really we work with. There is a story related of a person who was born in a rich family. But when he heard the Buddha, he took orders and he became very absorbed in practicing all the disciplines. His zeal was so great that he walked up and down the pathway near his house till his feet became lacerated. And tradition says that the path looked like a butcher's shambles. But the Buddha, who was somewhere far away, he could see all this. And he realized that this person, his name was Sona, was very sincere, but only he was overdoing all this. He was very devoted, but he did not know how to maintain balance. So the Buddha appeared where Sona was and went to his residence. But meanwhile, Sona began to think, I am working so hard at following what the teachings have said, but I seem to be getting nowhere. I'm not making progress. What if I go back home, where much wealth awaits me, and then I can use that wealth to help other people instead of doing what seems to be making a fruitless effort here. And so when the Buddha saw him, he said, Sona, are you not thinking like this? Thinking of going back to your worldly life? And Sona said, yes, I have been thinking like that because I have no success with my practice. And the Buddha said, before you became a monk, you were a good musician. You played well on a particular stringed instrument. And when the strings were taught, could you play well? Sona said, no, of course not. When the strings were too loose, could you play well? No, I could not. And the Buddha taught him and said, spiritual practice is like this. If you are too eager to gain your object, to reach a certain place, it is like making the strings too tight. And so you will not succeed. It is very interesting to find something very similar in the Mahatma letters. The master says, remember, too anxious expectation is not only tedious, but dangerous. Each warmer and quicker throb of the heart wears so much of life away. The passions, the affections are not to be indulged in by him who seeks to know. We can think here of our ordinary experience. If you are too anxious to find happiness, you will never find happiness. The anxiety itself is a form of unhappiness. So you are actually moving the wrong way. If you exert yourself a great deal to discover peace, peace will never come to you, because the exertion is a disturbance. If you are too eager to understand yourself, you may become a self-preoccupied egoist. So too much eagerness, too much anxiety is not desirable. That is why it was said, do not be anxious to become the pupil of a teacher, spiritual teacher. You do good work, purify your life, lead a holy life, and whatever you merit will come to you. This is an important part of the theosophical understanding of the path, that merit alone, worthiness, is what brings reward. Without your asking for the reward, perhaps not even thinking about what the reward might be, do the work and everything which is according to the law will happen. So one should not be eager for progress or for enlightenment, but wait for the right time and make yourself worthy. The middle path implies all that. Not to become unbalanced because of too much eagerness. On the other hand, we may be too slack, not really caring, and that too will leave us stagnating in the same place. Therefore, idleness is sluggishness. They are not desirable. What is the middle path between that? Not being somewhat indifferent, not caring, not being wholehearted or completely earnest, but superficially desiring to tread the path. On the other hand, the anxiety, the eagerness which becomes a new form of ambition, the constantly wishing to reach somewhere, these are the dangers which might occur when treading the path and are to be avoided. And the Mahatma goes on to say that the person on the path must not even desire too earnestly or too passionately the object he would reach, else the very wish will prevent the possibility of its fulfillment, or perhaps retard and throw it back. Nagarjuna's teaching was at that time something very new, because he spoke about this way of proceeding, which is a way of tranquility, of taking things as they come. And he said, if you have to look at something, listen to something, don't either immediately reject or accept. Neither rejection or acceptance are desirable. Can you simply observe? We can see that there are various states of mind that go contrary to this teaching. A mind which does not accept or reject is a still mind. It is looking, it is reflecting, trying to go deeper into things, not arriving at conclusions. This is again something Krishnamurti echoed or spoke of again, not to come to conclusions. Don't say, so-and-so has done this. He is doing the wrong thing. Perhaps it appears wrong to you. Wait and observe. Sympathetically observe. So, observing and listening without conclusions, without judgments, and always remaining calm. Again, in the Mahatma letters, this is taught, that it is the calm and unruffled mind which goes through life without wanting anything, without deciding anything, except in a pragmatical situation. We all have to conclude and decide things. We are not talking about that. But remaining with things, allowing things to be what they are, not trying to model them, change them to suit our own likes and dislikes. So that means that there must be emptiness within. Even if we try it for a short time, we will find that much of the stuff in the mind, manas, simply is dropped, is simply dropped. And the mind becomes less encumbered, free, inwardly receptive to everything, to the truth. And this is compared to what would happen to a seed which you plant in the soil. If every now and again you dig it up to see if the seed is growing, it will never grow. And similarly, if you find something which is of value, you see the truth in some words which are spoken or written, don't try to follow it up with your small mind. Receive it quietly. Give attention to it. Try to be more awake. Because if you are trying to work with it too much, to immediately put it into practice according to your own ideas, that truth may disappear. So allow that truth to remain deep in your heart, just as you would allow the seed to remain in the soil and grow by itself. All that we can do is to provide the right conditions for the seed to grow. Similarly, truth will reflect itself in a quiet mind, in an empty and pure mind. And when it does, we can let it be and not be ambitious to go further and to learn more and so on. So, it means being inwardly free. And when the mind is inwardly free, the greatest problem, which is the problem of egoism, solves itself. In fact, this whole thing is paradoxical, because ego is the great illusion maker. It is itself an illusion. And If we try too hard to wipe away that ego, the ego only increases. It struggles harder. It may overcome us. So, to observe the ego and all its actions, to understand what harm it does, this is what is important. And not really fighting that ego. So Nagarjuna's advice was that always there must be that state of quiet attention and receptivity to truths which we have not known. When the mind is quiet, we begin to perceive more and more what is hidden within everything in nature. As we said, in all the diverse things of the earth, there is the unity of the one reality which we are not able to see. But if the mind can be quiet, then we will begin to see what we cannot observe today. So the middle path is a path where excess of anything is to be avoided. Physically, psychologically, and in every other way. Not to indulge the body or bodies, not to ill-treat it, not to be over-anxious, not to be indifferent, not to be eager for progress, but not be careless about preparing for that progress. It is a path in which there is that complete equilibrium. And therefore, equilibrium is yoga. The middle path is a form of yoga. Yoga is not only the teaching of Patanjali. The word yoga is a very ancient word. In fact, scholars do not quite know when these concepts about yoga came into existence. But it was a long time ago. And it is said that Patanjali only brought together the teachings which already existed even before his own time. So from the most early days they knew that yoga is a state of profound inner balance which expresses itself in freedom from personal likes and dislikes, attractions and repulsions. And I think the middle way is really the way of the theosophist, that freedom from conclusions. All belief is a conclusion, especially religious belief. We do not know anything about the higher truths. We are still only at the beginning of the way. And belief is the most pernicious form of coming to conclusions. And in the TS, belief is not encouraged. Listening, study, meditation, reflection, that should become part of our way of life. And then we would be truly treading the middle path, not if we go and take the Buddhist vows or doing something external.